30,000 feet above the desert floor, I see it there below. A city with a legend, the West Texas city of El Paso. Where long ago I heard a song about a Texas cowboy and a girl. And a little place called Roses where he used to go and watch this beauty world. I don't recall who sang the song, but I recall the story that I heard. And as I look down on the city, I remember each and every word. The singer sang about a jealous cowboy and the way he used a gun to kill another cowboy. Then he had to leave El Paso on the run. Strong, he couldn't stay. He rode back just to die in that El Paso city. El Paso City, by the Rio Grande. I try not to let you cross my mind, but still I find there's such a mystery in the song that I don't understand. Mind is down there somewhere as I fly above the badlands of New Mexico. I can't explain why I should know the very trail he rode back to El Paso. Can it be that man can disappear from life and live another time? Does the mystery deepen cause you think that you yourself lived in that other time? Somewhere in my deepest thoughts, familiar scenes and memories unfold. These wild and unexplained emotions that I've had so long, but I have never told. Like every time I fly up through the heavens and I see you there below, I get the feeling sometime in another world I lived in El Paso. Mystery that died there in that desert sand so long ago. El Paso City, by the Rio Grande. A voice tells me to go and see. Another voice keeps telling me, baby, death awaits me in El Paso. El Paso City.
My good buddy Marty Robbins. Love Marty Robbins. If you're not a fan of Marty Robbins, haven't heard Marty Robbins, well, I'll tell you, he put out some good music. And he didn't let him hold him to a certain length of time, because like that song was over four minutes long. Yeah. Sang all those Western songs and gunfighter songs and stuff like that. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker on Tears Day. Yeah, it's the 16th of February, 2016. Time to get your donations in for the radio show to P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And then if you come on through this area of the country, you can drop by the imaginary Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse in Phillips Station. A couple of guys called me and said, I want to stop by and have a beer at Terrible Tommy's Steakhouse. I said, sorry, it's like spooks in the sky. It's imaginary. Yeah. Can't let the Christ insanity people have all the fun, right? I hope you heard my new addition to the studio here, Azira, I believe was her name. I hired her pretty cheap, and so you'll be hearing her voice quite a bit. I got several others I've hired here. They're working cheap, I'll tell you that. That's the only way I could hire them. I think these programs are going to improve our outreach. And there's a lot of written word that I can transfer to audio, and we can put up on the website and so forth and so on. So let me know what you think. Quite a few people out there send me information on militias, and I got to tell you, like I've said, I think before, my contact or sort of contact with militias goes back a long way. But, in fact, it goes all the way back into the 70s. And, however, my experience with militias has not been very fruitful, as far as I'm concerned. Most of the people that join militias are not that well trained, and if they are, they're more trained in field combat. Or let's go up in the woods and stand them off and all that kind of stuff. Well, the coming war is, obviously, there's going to be a lot of that, but that's not going to be the main part of the war. I'm afraid it's going to be psychological and many other ways, but it's not going to be fought traditionally. I mean, there will be some fought traditionally, that's for sure, just like it's being fought now in different parts of the world. But, and I don't really mean to rain on their parade, because they're well-meaning, but I found most of them are quite arrogant that they know it all. And that's not good. About the time you think you know it all is about the time you find out you don't know shit, really. So, don't associate me with militias. I'm sure they know what they want to do, and they're going to do it. But I'm afraid most of them are going to end up like the ones have all the way back since the 70s when I knew them. They're going to end up in jail or prison or dead, because that's not the way to fight the coming racial war. In fact, most of these militias don't even claim to be racial. Or they're into spooks in the sky and the Jesus thing and all that kind of stuff, which you can discount that as far as any help, boys and girls. It's not going to happen. The spooks in the sky are not going to save your ass. Only you can save your ass. And he who travels fastest travels alone, baby. In fact, if militias were going to be effective, they would have their home domiciles out in the country, and their operating positions should be in the city. That's where they'd be far more effective. But from what I see and hear, the ones that I hear from, they all think up in the mountains and out in the desert, way out there someplace. That's not where the main situation is going to be. Never was. In fact, a very effective lone wolf may never need to draw a gun, may never need to have a gun, and could be extremely effective, and in some cases, far more effective. Sample of that might be the thuggies over there. I think it was the thuggies in India, or it was one of those groups in India that they never used anything but a knife or a garrote. And they walk down the thoroughfare, down the sidewalk, and zero in on their target, and bingo, and be gone. And I'm not just talking about violence. I'm talking about gathering information, too. There's a lot more to being a lone wolf than any kind of violence. The less violence you have to use to win, the better. Whereas a lot of these cowboys out there in the right wing, the first thing they think about is violence. How many guns I've got, all that kind of stuff. And I don't see them registering piano wire or wire very soon, because that's been used as an age-old weapon and curls up in your pocket, no problem. That's right. Well, what do you think about this Scalia situation? It's interesting that his family didn't want an autopsy. Now, I can understand that, but I can also understand other reasons for it, so... But once I saw that he was going to make a ruling, a big ruling's going to affect the labor unions forever, that rose my interest. I think most things happen because someone wants them to happen, or there's some overriding reason for them to happen other than somebody just dropping dead.
And recently, city contracts from the nation's biggest police unions were leaked. And The Guardian is reporting they include guarantees that disciplinary records and complaints against officers be kept secret or destroyed. These are contracts between the police unions and the cities. And the cities are promising not to reveal who the bad cops are. Not only that, many contain numerous recurring clauses that slow down misconduct investigations. Slow down investigations. Isn't that the job of the police? To investigate bad things? That would be like an accountant, you know, your accountant signing a contract to not help you declare your goldfish as dependent. That's his job. His job is to help you declare the f***ing goldfish. Here's an example. In Independence, Missouri, if an officer is involved in a shooting, he or she can't be interrogated for at least 12 hours. Oh, the first 12 hours, that's only the key time to question somebody. What could they argue is the purpose of those 12 hours off? Well, the officer, you know, he just had a traumatic experience. I mean, killing somebody is very stressful, and he probably needs a little me time, you know, just a little time to take a warm bath and flip on an episode of Downton Abbey. When asked about these leaks, Chuck Canterbury, one of the union presidents, said, disciplinary files are removed because they affect career advancement. Good. I'm glad they affect career advancement. That's pretty much exactly what they're supposed to do. Listen, just because an officer done plowed through a bunch of school children while enjoying some methamphetamines doesn't mean he should miss out on his dream of making captain. And we only learned about all this because of a leak by hackers. So not only do the police keep bad cops secret, they kept the fact that they keep bad cops secret a secret. You conniving motherfuckers. I think rotten cops should have expiration dates on them so people know when exactly the cop went bad. You know? It's right there on the chest. Expired 6 months ago. After that, I don't know, you could use him in some banana bread or something.
With the Russian-backed Syrian army encircling Aleppo, cutting off Turkish supplies to rebels and advancing on the Islamic State's capital of Raqqa, a panicked Saudi Arabia and Turkey have set up a joint headquarters to direct an invasion of Syria that could lead to a vast escalation of the war. And there's only one man who could stop them, President Barack Obama. It is probably the most important decision Obama will make in his 8 years in office, since a Turkish-Saudi invasion risks a direct showdown between Russia and NATO, since Turkey is a member of the alliance. The U.S. traditionally has held tremendous power over client states like Turkey and Saudi Arabia. So, an order from Washington is usually enough to get such governments to back down. But Ankara and Riyadh are being led by reckless men whose continued existence in power might well depend on stopping a Syrian government victory helped by Russia, Iran, and the Kurds, and a humiliating defeat of the Turkish Saudi-backed Syrian rebels, who include some radical jihadist groups. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Prince Mohammed bin Salman have shown increasing defiance of Washington. Neither man is the legal ruler of his respective country. But both have seized power nonetheless. Erdogan is technically in a symbolic post, a presidency without power. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu should be leading the country the way Erdogan did when he was prime minister, but Davutoglu is still letting Erdogan call the shots. Erdogan is campaigning for a referendum that would make Turkey a presidential system to legalize the power he already has. But that hasn't happened yet. So, he is simply acting as a de facto executive leader while potential rivals are afraid to contest his overreach of power. Erdogan's increasing authoritarianism is alarming some people in Washington. He is routinely throwing in jail journalists and academics who dare criticize him. After a brutal crackdown in the Kurdish city of Cizre inside Turkey this month, leaving much of the city in ruins, Erdogan has turned his attention to the Syrian Kurds. They are among the best fighters on the ground against the Islamic State and are supported by both the US and Russia. And they are threatening to formalize their de facto autonomy inside Syria, which Erdogan has vowed to crush. By fighting the Islamic State, the Kurds are also messing with Erdogan's goal of overthrowing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Erdogan has staked much of his power on overthrowing Assad. A Syrian victory against Erdogan's five-year project of regime change in Damascus could mean the end of him politically. Sensing this danger, Erdogan has been increasingly belligerent toward anyone standing in his way. Erdogan showed his defiance of the Obama administration when he said, "How can we trust you? Is it me who is your partner or the Kurdish terrorists in Kobane?" On Sunday, Erdogan began shelling Syrian Kurdish areas in Aleppo province, especially the city of Azaz. "We will not allow Azaz to fall," Prime Minister Davutoglu vowed on Monday, reflecting Erdogan's hard line. Turkey's attacks also are aimed at preventing the Syrian government from sealing the Turkish border where the Islamic State and other jihadist groups have smuggled across fighters, weapons, and other supplies into Syria, as well as oil from Syria into Turkey. With his aggressive strategies toward his neighbors, Erdogan has been accused of wanting to establish a new Ottoman Empire. Azaz is near Dabik, the town where the Ottoman Empire began in 1516. Because of that symbolism, Turkey's defeat there could mean the death of Erdogan's neo-Ottoman dreams and perhaps of his presidency. For the Islamic State, Dabik is the place where a future Christian-Muslim battle will take place, heralding the end of the world. The Saudis appear equally spoiling for a fight. Prince Mohammed bin Salman is deputy crown prince, second in line to the crown. But his father, King Salman, is suffering from dementia, and the current crown prince, Mohammed bin Nayef, 56, is considered loyal to the U.S. But 30-year-old Mohammed has launched the most independent Saudi military policy in the history of the modern Saudi state. He is said not to trust the United States. And as defense minister, he has recklessly launched a disastrous war in Yemen, where despite widespread death and destruction the most powerful Arab army cannot defeat the poorest Arab nation. Mohammed has staked his credibility on the outcome of the Yemen war. But he also has vowed to check Iranian regional influence. So, he may be going for broke now by threatening to invade Syria. Turkey and Saudi Arabia have established a joint headquarters at Turkey's Incirlik base, 62 miles from the Syrian border. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu told a Turkish newspaper last week that Saudi warplanes and troops would be arriving at the base. The Saudis are also planning war games inside the kingdom with 150,000 troops from 20 Arab nations. Jordan, however, sensibly said it would not take part in an invasion unless it is led by U.S. and British troops and has a UN Security Council mandate with full coordination with Russia. However, the war clouds continued to darken along the Syrian border. On Sunday, Turkey began shelling Syrian Kurdish positions, including the town of Azaz in Aleppo province. And Saudi Foreign Minister Adel al-Jubeir said Russia will fail to save Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whom Jubeir vowed to overthrow. In response to Saudi threats, Hezbollah said it would slaughter Saudi troops if they invade. Assad confronting fanatical Erdogan. For his part, Assad has not ruled out that Turkey and Saudi Arabia will invade. He told the French press agency, AFP, on Monday, "Logically, intervention is not possible, but sometimes reality is at odds with logic, particularly when there are irrational people leading a certain state. That's why I don't rule that out for a simple reason. Erdogan is a fanatical person with Muslim Brotherhood inclinations. He is living the Ottoman dream. He believes that he has an Islamist mission in our region. The same applies to Saudi Arabia. The collapse of the terrorists in Syria is a collapse of their policies. I tell you that this process is surely not going to be easy for them, and we will certainly confront it. The risks of a Saudi-Turkish invasion of Syria are enormous. If soldiers from NATO member Turkish are killed by the Syrian army or Russian air force, will they seek NATO protection? If Saudi or its allied troops are killed, how would the US respond? An invasion could pit Saudi troops against Iranian forces on the same battlefield in what could be an historic Sunni-Shia battle. Despite the tough Turkish and Saudi rhetoric, Saudi Arabia at least has made it clear that it won't invade without the US leading the way. That puts the ball squarely in the Oval Office, where President Obama has resisted committing US combat troops to another war in the Middle East but reportedly wants to avoid further alienating US allies, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. At the State Department, John Kerry has made no statement about a possible invasion. Instead, he's using his close ties to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to try to nail down a partial ceasefire that is supposed to start on Friday. The ceasefire would allow continued fighting against terrorists, but the US and Russia disagree on exactly who should be included on the list of terrorists. Further, many of the U.S.-backed rebel groups collaborate with Al-Qaeda's Nusra Front in some areas, making targeting difficult even when there is U.S. Russian agreement of who's the terrorist. Other mixed signals have come from the Pentagon, where Defense Secretary Ashton Carter has welcomed the Saudi offer of ground troops. The matter was discussed at a NATO defense ministers meeting last week, but the only outcome was the acceptance of special forces from the United Arab Emirates. Obama has given no public indication of what he will do if Turkey and Saudi Arabia press ahead with an invasion. It's not even clear that he still has the leverage to stop Turkey and Saudi Arabia if they press ahead. Obama could simply cut U.S. losses in its disastrous Syrian regime change policy and accept a Russian and Iranian-backed Syrian government victory, but he would come intense criticism from Washington's influential neoconservatives as well as Republicans. But does he have another choice if he wants to avoid war with Russia? On Saturday, Obama called Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's not known what they discussed about a possible invasion of Syria. However, if Obama threatened to intervene if Russia doesn't end its military support for the Syrian military offensive, we could be in the middle of the most serious game of chicken since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nor do we know what Obama is telling the Turks and Saudis. On Monday, both countries toned down their bellicose rhetoric. Perhaps Obama delivered the only sane message possible: avoid a military confrontation with Russia at all costs. But it seems the lights will remain on at the Kremlin and the White House as the two nuclear powers look for some way to avoid a collision.
That was from our Lone Wolf Zira, fresh from the Middle East. A real breakdown on what's happening there, and it's looking like the Christians are going to get what they want. A bloodbath, a real, real, really big bloodbath in the Middle East. That's what they're inching towards. Yeah, you be careful what you pray for, Christians. You might get it. Only problem is we don't want to get it too. Keep your death wish to yourself. No Jews on death row? Well, guess what? Jedediah Murphy has spent 15 years on death row in Livingston, Texas. Like all the men in the Polonsky unit, he's been convicted of terrible crimes. On October 4, 2000, high on cocaine, he shot and killed a 79-year-old woman, stole her car, and used her credit cards to purchase alcohol and cigarettes. Less than a year later, at the age of 25, he was sentenced to death. Quote, "We first met a few months ago," said Rabbi David Goldstein, director of the Shabbat Lubavitch of West Houston, associate director of the Shabbat Outreach in Houston, and the lead Jewish chaplain in the Texas prison system. Quote, "I was in the prison to meet another inmate and came to visit him as well. We began talking, and he opened up, and he told me about his childhood with his Jewish grandparents in Texas who raised him because his parents in New York were not able to. And he told me about his childhood in foster homes after his grandparents were no longer able to help him." Well, when I showed him my tefillin and asked him what they were, continues Goldstein, he told me, "Yeah, those are tefillin. I was in foster care by the time I was 13 and never got to have a bar mitzvah." Well, anyhow, there's for those of you who'd like to know, there are death row Jews. This would not be the first time this rabbi would be putting this tefillin wrap around their arms on death row prisoners. He had done the same thing for Douglas Feldman, 55 years old, in 2013, a week before Feldman would receive a lethal injection at the Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville for a pair of double murders he committed some 15 years earlier. In that case, he was allowed to direct contact with the prisoner, the first Jew known to have been executed by the state of Texas, since the tefillin were considered man's last rites for which special allowances could be made. There you go, baby. Well, I see the Shabbat Center, the Jewish Shabbat Center over in the Ukraine, was firebombed the other day. How about that? Well, the Mormons are all worried about the hate crime laws. On July 24, 1847, Mormon pioneer ancestors arrived in Utah's Great Salt Lake Valley. They were fleeing persecution and justice, had fought a safe refuge, sought a safe refuge to practice their religion without fear for their lives. Our state was formed by those seeking refuge from religious motivated hate crimes. Well, I want to tell you something. If you read the history of the Mormons, especially in the Midwest, you'll find that the shoe flops on both feet, man, because they committed plenty of hate crimes against their neighbors. Over 150 years ago, in 1992, Utah adopted its first hate crimes law, thanks to Morris Sleeze Dees, which increased penalties for bias-motivated offenses. The law was an important step forward, sure, but the fight is not over, and it's time to take another step, they say. Oh, when will they learn? Since its ratification, our hate crimes law has rarely, if ever, convicted a single offender, but cost the state a fortune. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean there haven't been bias-motivated crimes between 1996 and 2014. Utah law enforcement agencies reported a total of 1,243 hate crimes against Utahns. 43% of the hate crime victims were targeted because of their race. Well, how many because they're white? Oh, none. We don't prosecute that shit. 23% because of religion. 18% because of ethnicity. 15% because of sexual orientation. North or South. And 1% because of disabilities. In December 2014, Rusty Andrade and Maxwell Christian were attacked because of their sexual orientation. They were French kissing on the city square, or in the Mormon tabernacle. They were approached by two men who made gay slurs and sexual references, and then physically attacked them. Andrade and Christian were left bruised and bloodied and emotionally broken. Yet a year later, the case remains under investigation, and the offenders are still walking free. Well, maybe that's because they were smart offenders and got out of there. One of the challenges for prosecutors is that our current law never defines what hate crimes are. We can't figure it out. We gotta get more days up here to explain this shit to us. Crimes of hatred or prejudice, because of what a person represents or is perceived to represent, whether that's race, gender, identity, sexual orientation, or how he or she worships the non-existent God. The words hate, bias, and prejudice are nowhere to be found in our current law, making it difficult for prosecutors to prove a hate crime took place. Well, also, since Utah is a high percentage white, they can't find many people to defend, you know, because they're not going to go after somebody who beats up and kills a white person. That's not on the statute books. Only all these other criteria. So just remember that up there in Utah, if you want to commit some kind of a love crime, you run to Utah, baby. That's why the Mormons ran to Utah to get away from prosecution for many crimes that they did commit. And like the crimes they committed against white people who were crossing their state or their area in covered wagons and butchered them and pretended they were Indians. Oh, yeah. Was that a hate crime? I think they killed about 40, 50 white people, massacred them with tomahawks. Oh. Well, that's not a hate crime because it's okay for religious people to commit crimes. It's okay. This modern-day race mixing and hate crimes and all this kind of crap comes out of back in the 50s in Korea, the brainwashing in the prison camps by the North Koreans, spurred on by the Red Chinese. And then it got over into Russia. The Soviet Union used it, of course. And that's where it came from. When I was in the Birch Society, I met personally with Leonard Patterson, a black communist, and Julia Brown, black communist, who they had been undercover for the FBI, and they told me straight out one of our main things was to encourage race mixing. Not only to turn people into Reds, but to get them into race mixing. They pushed it big time. So it was a part of the brainwashing system that was being used at that time by the Soviet Union. So anyhow, there you go. So anybody wants to pick up a book on brainwashing of the 50s and on up to present, this whole race mixing mess and even the hate crime things that come out of it, it's all a product of the Cold War. Yeah, the Cold War. And so read about it. You want to see it in action? Well, get that movie, The Manchurian Candidate. Not the recent one with the black guy, but Frank Sinatra's in it. watch that. That's where it's at. And that, you know, that movie was kept out of circulation for a long time. They said that Frank Sinatra kept it out. But I think, and he may have, but I think it had more to do with the fact that they didn't want people to catch on to what the hell was happening to him. But they didn't need to do that because people still don't catch on to what's happening to him. It's straight out brainwashing. The use of mesmerism, hypnosis, all kinds of things, even and drugs, to drag people down into this quagmire. So it's people say, well, how's this all happening? Well, that's how it's all happening. There's nothing secret about it. Anybody can find out just by picking up a book or two. If you pick up the book, The Crowd, you'll find out all about it, too. I mean, there's several elements to it, but it's quite simple, brainwashing and so forth. Of course, these people will fight you to the death that, oh, no, this is not brainwashing. This is our idea to make a better society. Bullshit. They're not making a better society. This society is going to collapse in large part because of all this bullshit. And stamping out racism and all that kind of stuff, that's a pipe dream that'll never happen. Along with that brainwashing is every time you turn on the radio or TV, you hear white people apologizing. Oh, my God, my ancestors were, they had black slaves. Oh, yeah, what can I do? What can I do? How can I come up with money to give to Negroes to make amends? And every time I turn on the radio or TV now, that's what you hear. Every time you watch a movie, every time you watch a TV show, they get it in there some one place or another. It's sort of a spin-off of how the Jews operate, or at least part of the Jews. Yeah, baby. Some people are immune to it. Luckily, I'm immune to it, and I hope you're immune to it. And if you're immune to it, you laugh about it. You say, people are crazy. They're absolutely insane. Of course, also add in the herd instinct thing, you know. Don't you find it amazing that, you know, there were homosexuals. I'm sure there's always been homosexuals around, but all of a sudden, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are homosexuals? I don't buy it. Or if I buy it, there's something really screwy going on, whether somebody's putting something in the post-toasties or the Wheaties or the oats. I don't know. But it doesn't even make sense that in just maybe 20 years the world has gone, Western society has gone crazy with homosexuality and transgender and all this kind of shit. No, it's something where, well, it's psychological that they're feeding them in the schools and so forth, but it's also something about diet, and nobody wants to release the information on it because they know they'll lose their job if they connect homosexuality to some diet and medicine and dirty air, dirty water, and all that kind of crap. Well, here's a little thing out of history of the person in our background that believed that all men are created equal. And the same guy was one of the so-called fathers of the Revolution, Thomas Jefferson, who never fired a shot in the Revolution and proclaimed all beings, troglodytes, are equal. And he was screwing a nigger on the side. And here it says, in a famous letter to Joseph Marx, a prominent Jewish, well, wait a minute, I should have read it from the top. Jefferson had limited contact with Jews, and his knowledge of them was essentially limited to what he had learned from studying the Bible. Nonetheless, he manifested extreme sensitivity to the Jewish condition, probably because they all were borrowing money from Jews back then. In a famous letter to Joseph Marx, a prominent Jewish merchant who helped to found the Richmond's first synagogue, He stated his belief that the reading of the King James Bible in public schools was a cruel addition to the wrongs that Jews had historically suffered by imposing on them a course of theological reading which their consciences did not permit them to pursue, unquote. Well, I think it was a cruel addition to Aryans having to read that crap too, and it's led to pretty much our downfall. However, Jefferson simultaneously held Judaism itself in low regard. He was deeply troubled that the Jewish God was a being of terrific character, cruel, vindictive, capricious, and unjust. Well, after the Library of Congress was burned down by the British during the War of 1812, Jefferson offered his entire eclectic collection of books, some 6,487 volumes, which he'd spent over 50 years accumulating, as a replacement. One of those books was an edition of the Talmudic tractate Baba Kama, Leiden, 1637, printed, containing the Hebrew text, its Latin translation, and a commentary by the prominent Dutch Hebrewist Jew, Constantine La Imperieur, in which Jefferson inscribed his initials at page 65 and 145. So you think we got a problem? We've had a problem a long time, boys and girls. You think that Trump's crazy? A lot of our founding fathers were a little nuts, too. And, of course, you know, they nowadays they always wrote, the founders, the founding fathers, the great Constitution, and all that stuff. Oh, boy. It's insane. Like I say, it's insane.
For white people, it was just another great week. They never saw it coming. They had no warning. Then, the day before the Super Bowl, it happened.
Beyonce released a new music video that embraces her black heritage.
Beyonce video is unapologetically black.
Tribute to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Showcase for black men.
Claims her blackness like never before.
Honey, get in here.
What is it? What's wrong?
Black.
Out of nowhere.
I think Beyonce is black.
The day Beyonce turned black.
Guys, I don't understand this new song.
Hot sauce in my bag swag? What does that mean?
Maybe this song isn't for us.
But usually everything is!
It was the day that shook the whole white world.
We have to go. We have to leave America. Beyonce is black.
Amy, I'm black.
What? No, you're not. You're like my girl.
Yeah, but I can still be black. There's black people all over the world. That guy's black.
Huh. I know he's black. Beyonce is black. What about single ladies?
She was black in that.
What about Jumpin' Jumpin'?
She was black in that, too.
What about the Pink Panther movie?
Okay, yeah, she was white in that.
It was the day white people lost their Beyonce.
Getting word now that Beyonce isn't the only black celebrity. Some are saying Kerry Washington may also be black.
No, it can't be. She's on ABC.
I don't understand. How can they be black? They're women.
I think they might be both.
So what's going on out there?
New Beyonce video.
Oh, it was the day they lost their damn white minds.
Ashley? Honey? What are you listening to?
The new Beyonce song. I really like it.
Oh, God. You're black, too.
Care, that is my daughter. Your parents are going to bed.
Remember, you invited us for a play date?
Oh, that's right. Thank God.
Thank God? Really?
The day Beyonce turned black. Rated NC-17 for white people and G for black people.
Mommy, is Taylor Swift still white?
I don't know, sweetheart. Just close your eyes and it'll be over in the morning.
Well, I think white people deserve to be made fun of, I make fun of them too. But there you go, right in their face on SNL on TV. Yeah, stupid white people. Stupid white people. Yep. Well, I think Hillary's right. We got to take all the guns away from white people. Then they'll have to get really barbaric and use baseball bats, by God. She wants to take all the guns away. Let her take them away, and then we'll revert to real savagery. Let's see what she has to say here.
This has had an impact on the 2016 presidential race, with Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton vowing to curb gun control. During a campaign stop in New Hampshire, Clinton said she would expand background checks, making it easier to hold negligent manufacturers and dealers accountable.
This epidemic of gun violence knows no boundaries, knows no limits of any kind. How many people have to die before we actually act? Before we come together as a nation?
Last week's campus shooting in a college in Roseburg, Oregon, left 9 people dead and another 9 wounded. Despite past efforts by President Barack Obama to get Congress to act on limiting gun ownership, the all-powerful National Rifle Association has successfully lobbied against any changes.
Yeah, the more I think of it, I think they should take the guns away. Take all the guns away from the white people, or the white people that are stupid enough to give them up, and let the non-whites go absolutely bonkers, slaughter from coast to coast. You think maybe then white people might get the message? If they do, they could probably clean it up with baseball bats. Some interesting tidbits of final words from famous people. Walt Disney wrote down Kurt Russell, whatever that means. I know Kurt Russell played in some of the movies. Winston Churchill said, "Oh, I'm so bored with it all," just before he died. Wow. Charlie Chaplin said, "Why not? After all, it belongs to him." Mm-hmm. Steve Jobs said, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow," just before he died. Boris Karloff said, "Walter Pigeon," just before he died. Interesting. Henry David Thoreau, he said, "Moose Indian," just before he died. I think these guys were all drinking on their deathbed. Let's see who else here. Wait a minute. Oscar Wilde said, "Either this wallpaper goes or I go." That was pretty funny. Okay, here. Gustav Mahler, the famous musician, said, "Mozart" was his final word. Marie Antoinette, she said it in French, so I don't know. Pardonnez-moi, monsieur. I wonder if that was after her head was rolling around in the alley. Huh. Well, that's sort of interesting. Not really interesting. Well, Bill Clinton has said it, and I know he believes it. Bill Clinton has risked inflaming the Democratic primary's current debate over race, telling a rally in support of his wife in Tennessee that everyone has some African ancestry. Well, you know, there are white people in Africa. Maybe a lot of people might have white South African ancestry. Quote, unless your ancestors, every one of you, are 100%, 100% from sub-Saharan Africa, we're all mixed-race people, unquote, the former president told a crowd in Memphis on Friday. I don't know what he's trying to prove with that. Clinton's comments, which echoed the actor Meryl Streep's controversial statement at the Berlin Film Festival that we're all Africans, really. Well, why don't you go back to Africa then, Meryl? Came 3 weeks ahead of the Tennessee primary, part of the Super Tuesday on March 1st. In polls in the state, his wife, Hillary, holds a 3-1 lead over Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. In 2008, she soundly defeated Barack Obama there, too. However, Tennessee also has a high number of undecided Democrats, 26%. And among registered voters, Clinton's negative ratings are the highest in any state. Democrats have warned that if she is the nominee, she might drive a stronger turnout of Tennessee Republicans against her. Well, since we're all niggers, it don't make any difference, does it, Hillary? Yeah, I think Bill wanted to be a nigger. He prayed to be a nigger. He had sex with a lot of niggers. Yeah, I get a bang out of this fake love affair with Bill Clinton and Hillary. I think she's got the penis and he's got the vagina. That's the only thing that seems logical. Well, here's another crybaby. Crybaby. Wah, wah. I had to speak to this story. I am distressed and disheartened, as are many Americans. The story of race in America is a story of much stress, much shame, much pain, and a great disconnect in the general between the black and the white. Despite all the amendments and laws and promises and billions of dollars spent and made to black America, we as a country have not been able to bring a sense of trust and social alliance between the races. This country was never able to become colorblind. The bias that has been built into the American culture against the black race has generated a total mistrust of the former black slave community towards the American majority. And it drives me crazy. As a country, we have never reached real comfort levels between the races. One doesn't like the other, and the other doesn't respect the other. All memories and misrepresentations seem to be set in stone from one generation to another. The changes affected by law and constitutional amendments always fall short of social success. I think it sounds like Mother Nature's involved here, don't you? After 150 years of public emancipation and legal freedom, the black community is still separate, many say very unequal. Every effort made to remedy the difference between the black and the white falls short of the intended goal, colorblindness. Well, I guess our eyesight's still pretty good. Yeah. But colorblindness is bad. And recently, both candidates sought to appeal to black voters Friday. Clinton campaigned in Denmark, South Carolina, where she outlined a $125 billion economic revitalization proposal aimed at giving niggers everything they want, improving infrastructure, and building housing in communities of poverty and systematic racism. So she wants to dump $125 billion into the nigger neighborhoods. Well, what's that going to get you, Hillary. Sanders, appearing earlier in Minneapolis at a forum on race and education opportunity, was confronted by attendees who demanded specifics about his views on reparations to African-American descendants of slavery, goddammit. I know you're scared to say black. I know you're scared to say reparations, one woman said. Sanders said the problem wasn't confined to race, but investments in poor communities were long overdue. They've had plenty of investments in black communities, but they tear them down. They burn them down. One man yelled, "Say black." Sanders responded, "I've said black 50 times. That's the 51st. Okay, Ta-Nehisi Coates, an influential writer on racial issues, drew attention to the issue recently in an Atlantic Magazine essay entitled "The Case for Reparations." Coates has said he will vote for Sanders. Well, anyhow, this reparations thing's been around a long time. I remember this black preacher out there in California that was playing the conservative line, and he was, the conservatives loved him. Anytime they could get a nigger into their group, their conservative meeting, they used to be pet niggers. Now they're all over the place, but back then there weren't very many. He'd be the pet nigger. They all loved him. He wanted reparations, and his white people said, "Well, yeah, you should have reparations. Yeah, but the first 50% goes in my pocket, baby. I need some Cadillac." Well, now that we know we all niggas and came out of the deepest, darkest jungles of Africa, I can get out of here and quit wasting my time. 14:05. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day.